NEA jazz master from Philadelphia. He's been on hundreds of recordings since the 60s and dozens of his own, countless with jazz musicians like Dizzy Gillespie and James Moody, Yusuf Lateef and Ron Carter and Stan Getz, a six-time recipient of Best Pianist by the Jazz Journalists Association, 9 Grammy nominations, including last year's Book of Intuition trio album. His name is a mark of quality. Whenever you see Kenny Barron's name on a record, it's like, this is going to be good. A real pleasure to have you here.
Thanks.
Tell me about your early attraction to jazz. I mean, you had a piano in the house and everybody had to learn it, right?
Yeah, that's true. I had 2 brothers and 2 sisters. So we all played piano. But myself and my oldest brother, Bill, who's a tenor saxophonist, we're the only ones who became professional musicians. And my interest in jazz started, I guess, he had a big collection of 78 recordings.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I used to listen to those and... there was some in particular that really grabbed me. Remember, it was Birth of the Cool?
Oh, yeah.
Miles Davis? I don't know what it was about those records. They just got me. And then also Philly had a really great jazz station, 24-hour jazz station. So you could hear Dizzy, you could hear Sun Ra, everybody, you know, Stan Getz, you know, everybody. So that kind of whetted my appetite for the music.
Now, I don't have an older brother, but that seems like the best way to learn about music is to have older brothers telling you what's cool, right?
He was into some different stuff, but I mean, he got me my first gig. You know, I was about 14 in the band, a band that he was playing with, but it was a dance band. You know,
right.
They played what was called cabarets. So in Philly, so you had to play for, well, first of all, the audience dancing, then you had to play for a dancer, usually a scantily clad woman.
Right.
We called them shake dancers or exotic dancers. You had to play for a comedian. You had to play for a vocalist. So it was a whole show. You know, it was a whole variety show that you had to play for. So, and that was some great experience, you know, great experience. But Bill's, his own music was definitely left of center.
Yeah.
You know, definitely left of center. You know, he had... when he left Philly, he had, in his room, he had a library of books about all kinds of subjects about music. He had one book called The Schillinger Method, which was very popular among forward-thinking musicians, and it was how to compose music using graphs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was different. It was different, you know. So his own music, he had a lot of devices that he used which weren't common at the time. Like he would use in terms of chord symbols, you know, people would usually use a triangle which meant the chord was major, or a dash which meant minor. He had a square sometimes which meant no third in the chord.
Oh, wow.
So the chord became ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, major or minor, it's up to you. You know, so things like that, you know. And then he loved Cecil Taylor. When he moved to New York, he worked with Cecil Taylor for a while. So he was definitely forward-thinking. But I guess because of our age difference.
Yeah, 15 years or something?
17 years, you know. But I wound up listening to a lot of, you know, bebop was my thing. That's what I loved, you know. But I also listened to younger guys. I mean, I loved Ornette Coleman, you know, as he did as well, you know. There was some similarities and some differences, you know.
And he was already in New York when you made the trip after high school?
Yeah, he moved to New York maybe about 4 or 5 years before me, you know. I moved to New York and I graduated from high school, so I was about 17 or 18 when I moved. I wound up actually moving next door to him, and it was a great block, East 6th Street. I lived at 314. He lived at 3, whatever it was. I can't remember. But anyway, upstairs, Elvin Jones and Pepper Adams shared an apartment. Across the street were a bunch of guys from Philly, like Lee Morgan, Tootie Heath, Reggie Workman. They shared an apartment.
Yeah.
Up 2 doors up, or 3 doors up, was Ted Kirsten, the trumpet player.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great neighborhood, you know. But I could walk to the Five Spot.
Oh, boy.
And the Jazz Gallery. So... I would go to the Five Spot, and James Moody was working there. And he knew my brother, so he said, come on, sit in. So I did, and Moody hired me. You know, and he had an interesting band. It was a sextet, and with a trumpet player named Dave Burns, and Steve Davis, who was from Philly, played with Train. A drummer from Philly named Edgar Bateman. and a trombone player named Tom McIntosh. And we were playing mostly Tom's music, which was kind of complicated.
Yeah.
You know, so it was fun. So I did that for a while, and then Moody got the call to go back with Dizzy.
Oh,
in
yeah.
a small group.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to run into him one day on Broadway, and I just got married, and he said, listen, Dizzy's pianist, who was Lalo Schifrin, is leaving. You interested?
Got to say yes.
Yeah.
Even if you're not ready, right?
Yeah, so of course I was interested. So I went up to Birdland to talk to Dizzy, and he hired me. Never heard me play a note.
Wow.
Yeah, so that for me, and it was there for 4 years. That was a great experience.
What did you learn from Dizzy? It seems like he had a lot to teach people about for everything from Latin jazz to how to play a solo and tell a story, you know?
Well, yeah, but and a lot of them, he didn't sit down and tell you, okay, do this, do that. Sometimes it was just by osmosis,
yeah.
Just being in that environment, listening to him and listening to Moody, you know. But one of the things he did do is he knew a lot about voicings and chords on the piano. He played fairly decent piano.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a matter of fact, I remember some nights if the club wasn't crowded,
yeah.
he would chase me away from the piano with the last set, and he would play, sit down, play a couple of songs with Moody,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he wasn't a hell of a soloist, but he knew chords, he could comp,
yeah.
you know.
And he had fun doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And he knew a lot about rhythms, too.
Yeah.
And where they came from, because he and how to get certain kinds of sounds. He would tell the Ree Collins sometimes, do this with your left foot, do this with your right foot. Hit the cymbal here to get a certain kind of sound. So he knew.
Wow.
He knew, yeah.
Another guy who was important for you coming up was Yusuf Lateef, who encouraged you to go back to school, which seems like an interesting thing for a band leader to have not only you, but a lot of the members in the band do,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, at one point, everybody in the band was in school.
Yeah.
Tootie Heath and Bob Cunningham and myself. You know, and Yusuf was teaching at Manhattan Community College.
Mm-hmm.
So we all had, he encouraged all of us. We all went back to school. We all had classes with Yusuf.
Yeah.
And we all had other classes. I had math, kind of math I'd never had before in my life, you know. But again, it was a great experience. And one of the things that happened, I remember we would go on the road, and I would ask the teacher, especially in the math class, what material do you think, because I got to go travel, what material do you think you'll cover in the 2 weeks that I'm going to be gone? So mm-hmm. she said, well, this and this is it. And when we came back, I was usually ahead of the class because there were no distractions on the road.
Yeah, right.
You know, so, you know, when in the at night and the gig is over, or even during the day, because there was a lot of time during the day, you know. So instead of hanging out and doing this and that, you hit the books. So when we came back, like I said, I was ahead of the class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a great feeling. I even made the dean's list.
Wow. Now, another one of your early partners who became a kind of a lifelong musical partner was Ron Carter. And yeah. How did you meet him?
I actually met Ron on a recording session. It was my brother's recording session, actually. But it was a session that wasn't under his name. Mm. We were doing Brazilian music.
Mm.
And it was some company. And when the record came out, it was called the Brasileiros or something corny like that. You know, but that's when we first met. Mm-hmm. You know, then I would see him periodically at Birdland. And first time I worked with him outside of that recording, he started a band with, well, we had done a couple of recordings before that with Joe Henderson and somebody else. Anyway, he started a band with two basses, himself and Buster Williams.
Oh, wow.
And Ben Reilly suggested me. So that was how we hooked up. You know, and we've been friends and you know, compatriots and fellow musicians since then.
Yeah. I feel like you guys are peanut butter and jelly. It's just like you go so well together. I mean, there were so many great pianists around the time, and one of the names that you point out as one of your big heroes was Tommy Flanagan.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us why you love Tommy Flanagan so much.
Well, I love Tommy because, when I first heard Tommy, I was in junior high school, and a friend of mine had a record. It was with, I'm not sure, Tommy and I think it was Sonny Rollins and maybe Doug Watkins.
Okay.
Yeah. And they played Dave Brubeck's In Your Own Sweet Way on there. And when I heard that, I said, well, who's that piano player? Because I'd never heard of him, you know, and that I was a fan for life.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that attracted me to Tommy first was his touch. Yeah. His touch and lyricism.
Yeah.
Those two things primarily, they really got me. So he was till the day he passed away, And one of the things that stands out of my mind is we did a dual piano record.
Right, yeah.
Called Together. And that was one of the few times I've actually been scared to death. Because, you're playing with your hero.
Right, right.
I couldn't play for listening to him, so.
Tommy spent a lot of years backing up Ella Fitzgerald and made a lot of his career as a sideman, which you ended up doing as well. And I wonder what you felt about being a sideman. It seems like you took a lot of pride in supporting other people.
Oh, yeah, I think it's important. For a sideman, it's about supporting whoever's up front. Mm-hmm. That's fun, actually, to make something work, to contribute, make a contribution to the sound of the band, Somebody comes to hear the band and you're killing with, and the band sound, it's not about you, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's not about you, it's about the band.
Right.
It's about the band. So that's one of the things I love. I love to support, I don't want to draw attention to myself.
I think that even goes to your first album, your debut as a leader, Sunset to Dawn, I think, 73, but there was one in 67, the Jimmy Owens, Kenny Barron Quintet.
Oh,
what was that album about?
Well, originally, the concept, because Jimmy and I met, we were both teenagers.
Uh-huh.
And originally we had talked about, we should do a record just using guys who are under 21. So time got past us a little bit. So, but that was essentially what that record was about, mm-hmm. And it was a fun record, Jimmy threw me a curve in that there was one song on there in 7/4. And I had never played in 7/4. It was kicking my butt, trying to play in 7/4. But I got through it,
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you started leading your own bands, five great records in the 70s. And I think they were all like band albums, too. There may have been maybe a Ted Dunbar record in there.
Oh, that was a duo record.
Right. But what finally led you to start leading your own trio?
I don't know. People started calling me well, it was a club called Bradley's, so I started having a trio there. And then after Stan Getz died, the guy who was his road manager and did most of his booking decided, let me do that for you. So he did, and I started working with the trio. And at the time, it was Ben Riley and Ray Drummond.
Mm-hmm.
We did... We went to Europe a lot, a lot. We did a lot of tours over there. So that was kind of the beginning. And then I started working around New York, with the trio at Bradley's or sometimes the Vanguard,
mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the beginning of that.
Now, you touched on Stan Getz a little bit there. That's when I started as a jazz DJ, and that's when I first heard Kenny Barron. It was just such a beautiful piano to go to that with that beautiful saxophone. It seemed like another just a great combination. I know you had worked a little bit with Stan before he kind of hired you on as his regular pianist.
I don't even know where he got my number from. But I took Chick Corea's place, and it was that's what was called his Captain Marvel band. So it was Stanley Clarke and Tony Williams, and we were playing mostly Chick's music. So that was fun. It was about two weeks worth of work. And then after that, he gave me a great compliment. You're the consummate musician. Mm-hmm. So, then I didn't hear from him anymore for a while. Mm-hmm. Then he started calling me. He took a residency at Stanford University. And then he started calling me just to come out there and do things with him. And then eventually we started working on something. We didn't work that much during the school year. That was teaching.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really take a lot of time off. But we were very busy during the summer. We did all the festivals and So that was the beginning.
I wanted to get into your teaching. You started, in 73 at Rutgers.
Right.
And as an educator, these days kids have a lot of advantage with the internet and just jazz classes. I'm not sure there were many schools you could go to with jazz classes in the 40s and 50s. What do you think the kids today, with all their advantages, are they missing anything?
Probably the one thing they may be missing is... emotional content. Yeah, it's very intellectual.
Yeah.
There's a former student of mine who posts online, and he's a very brilliant player, but he, he posts these exercises almost every other day. Mm-hmm. You know, going, doing this up a third and doing this. And that's so intellectual, you know, and there is that danger mm-hmm. from academia that right. you start to play your lessons, you know, rather than just play, you know, mm-hmm. play with what you feel. You know.
I know one of your students was Aaron Parks. He's from Seattle, one yeah. of our favorite hometown
yeah,
guys.
Yeah.
What do you remember about working with young Aaron Parks?
Oh, Aaron was he was great. I mean, every week he would come in with some of his original music. Because mm-hmm. I had a studio with two grand pianos. And we would just play through his stuff, play through standards. And his playing then was nowhere near what it is now.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, and not due to me, but I mean, it's just a natural progression. Mm-hmm. You know, because he was 16 when he started studying with me.
Right.
So he wasn't even supposed to be there. You know.
Now, you like to play with younger guys. Yeah. Your Book of Intuition trios, a couple of younger guys nominated for a Grammy, I should say. Why is it that I see that a lot, older musicians hiring younger musicians? Is it a way to keep you kind of on your toes, or is it a way to get a cheaper musician? I mean,
No, it's definitely not a way to get a cheaper musician. You know, no, it's a way to keep you on your toes, yeah. You know, because they have a lot to offer. They come to the table with something. Plus, I don't want to tell them how to play.
Yeah. So
when you hire them for what they do, so you let them do what they do.
Right.
You know, so Jonathan Blake, I mean, he kind of kicks me in my butt.
Yeah.
You know, he throws me all kinds of curves, you know, which is a good thing.
Yeah, right.
You know, so him and Kiyoshi together, I mean, it's a great rhythm section.
Jonathan said something really interesting, I thought, when I was checking out an interview about him talking about you. He's like, oh, this ought to be good. And he said something interesting, that you know how to read a room really well. You walk into a club and you know what to play and what to play next. How do you think you develop that skill?
Getting old, I guess. I don't know, but I mean, it's not unique to me. There are a lot of older guys who don't, you know, if the audience is full of blue-haired ladies, you're not going to play your most out stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't think they would respond too well to it, you know. Mm-hmm. And you do want to reach them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what's important. You know, not that you want to play down to them, but you do want to reach them, you know. And once you reach them, you can actually play anything after that.
Yeah. I find that so, and more so than just about any other music, jazz really feeds off the audience. Do you find that true?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Very much so, you know. I remember playing some little club in Philly, and there were about four people in there, mm-hmm. you know. But they were so into the music.
Yeah.
It was like you had a club full of people. I mean, they were really into the music. They were enjoying themselves, which helped us enjoy ourselves. And we played better. You know, it was a nice vibe. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you feed off an audience and they're responding to you, and it's almost like you can't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
You know.
And that seems like that's kind of been your mission, your goal in music, is to always be playing better and to find a way to get challenged every time and to find a lot of different variety of music and styles to play.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of like to do that. Sometimes it doesn't work. You know, I mean, but that's...
that's life,
that's
right?
Life, yeah. You know, you reach for something and you say, you know, oh, damn, it doesn't work, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's the nature of the beast, you know, and that's what makes it interesting.